At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting. Our 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group and attend a group conscious meeting. And my name's Robin, I'm an alcoholic. And I've done all of those. And the most important thing is I'm an alcoholic, you know. Whenever I chair, people begrudgingly read more about alcoholism because it's too long. But that's my favorite reading because, you know, I came in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I did not belong here. The truth was I did belong here, I just didn't want to be here. And I had to do everything they talk about doing in there until I was convinced. And alcohol was really my great convincer. Alcohol convinced me that I am an alcoholic. And you know, when I was finally beaten enough, I came in and I got a sponsor, and you know, I did what she said to do. I did whine a lot, but I still did what she said to do. She always told me she didn't care about how I felt. She just cared about what I was doing. And you know, and because of that, today I don't want to drink, and I have a wonderful life, and I'm so glad to be here. And you know, if you're new, just keep coming back. That's what they told me, and I don't know if you were like me. Nobody wanted me coming back. Nobody did except you guys, so... and now it says the group asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from moving around talking while the speaker is sharing. And now it's time to introduce the speaker. She asked me if I would qualify for 20 minutes, but I told her I couldn't. you know, one of the greatest experiences that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous is step 12 and the opportunity to work with other alcoholics. And I've had an opportunity to not only work with this girl, but actually become her friend, you know, and she's one of the women that, you know, I love dearly. But there's one important thing that, you know, we all, as we get sober, we go through things, and, you know, sometimes the things we go through aren't very good, and I'll let her share that in her story, but she had an experience that she went through that was terrible, but she came in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and talked about it, and no matter what, that girl didn't drink, and, you know, I watched her go through that process, and she was very new in sobriety when it happened, and, you know, later on, I had that experience, and because of her example, you know, I did not have to drink again, and I'm just so glad to be here and so glad to introduce Jacqueline.
I'm Jacqueline, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm terrified. So it's an honor to be asked to speak. Thank you, Robin. My sobriety date is April 5th, 2003, and that is just, you know, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just going to tell you a little bit what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I don't think I'm any different than many of you. You know, I just come from a middle-class family, and my home was very dysfunctional, and but that was my normal, so I didn't really know how dysfunctional it was until I got older. I know from probably very early age, I never really felt like I fit in. I didn't feel good enough. I didn't feel pretty enough. I didn't feel smart enough. And I just didn't fit in. We moved around a lot as small children. And so, you know, that didn't help, you know, add to the feelings of inadequacy. You know, always in a new school trying to make new friends, always in a new neighborhood trying to make new friends. And that was just how it went. Until I was an adult and I moved out. I don't know if I was an adult, I was 17. So. I wasn't, you know, alcohol really wasn't my thing. I liked other things other than alcohol, and out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, I won't, you know, talk more about it than that, but that was my thing in high school and early on. I didn't like alcohol. I didn't like the way alcohol tastes, and so I was a late bloomer. I probably started drinking when I was maybe 20, and I really had to work at it. You know, the sweet drinks, you know, it just, oh, I don't know, it just took me forever to get the hang of it. But once I got the hang of it, it was on. So I don't know, you know, they talk about that line that we crossed, and I guess that was, you know, the line that I crossed. I can't, you know, I can't say when or where or remember why, and nothing, you know, specific or tragic happened, but, you know, there was a time when, you know, I started using alcohol to do everything. You know, I needed alcohol to get ready to go out. I needed alcohol to go to the store. I needed alcohol to just, you know, have a phone conversation, just to function, just to make me feel at ease, you know, that ease and comfort that comes with taking a drink. As a young adult out on my own, you know, I was able to work and function, and I never lost a job from drinking, and didn't really seem to be a problem. You know, I mean, I always had terrible hangovers, and I always had the guilt, the shame, and the remorse, you know, that made me drink even more. I mean, I had that right from the get-go because I always did tragic things while I drank, and it was never good for anybody that was around, especially myself. And I did a lot of geographic changes. You know, I was in Orlando for a while, and then, you know, I was with the wrong crowd, and I didn't really think alcohol was my problem. If I could just stop doing this other stuff, you know, I'd be okay. So I moved to Ocala when I was like 22, and I was like, oh my God, what am I doing here? It was, we called it Slocala. There was just like nothing to do. There was one bar, and it was a cowboy bar, and I was not a cowgirl, and I was like, oh my God, what am I doing here? And so I drove back and forth to Orlando every weekend because, you know, that's what normal people do, you know, drive to the bars. And oh, by the grace of God, I never, you know, got a DUI. I never was in an accident related to alcohol, and, you know, never injured anybody. But that was normal to me. You know, you go to Orlando to party, and then you come back. And, oh, my gosh, I can't even believe that. Ocala worked for a little while, and I was in a business that lent itself to drinking while you were working. So that was good, and that worked well, and I could drink a little bit in the evening, you know, just to kind of, you know, feel a little good, and then by the time I got off, then I could really, you know, get to it. After a while, you know, I had done enough, you know, tragic things in that area that, you know, I felt like I needed to move back to Orlando. Because, again, I had gotten involved with this other stuff, and that if I could just get away from this other stuff, you know, I'd be okay. So I came back to Orlando, and just, you know, the same story over and over and over again. So when I was around 27, I got married, you know, to somebody that, you know, I didn't know super well, and met him in a bar, and we were in love, and we're still married somehow. But we got married, and we partied like nobody's business. I mean, we lived to party, and I was still, you know, I guess highly functional. You know, I still went to work. I still, you know, thought I did great things for other people. I thought I was basically a good person. I just had really bad luck. You know, I was always losing my car, coming home at 2 or 3 in the morning by myself, or not coming home. And that was, you know, not always good. I could never really get my husband to play along. He didn't, you know, really wasn't the type of alcoholic that I am. Or was, and am, would be if I picked up a drink. I think I always think, you know, I wish I'd have gotten sober earlier. But I know for me, it took everything that it took, you know, to get here. You know, I wrecked my car with my young nephews in it, and my husband found me passed out in the backyard, and I had no idea what had happened, and my nephews were crying in the back seat. I was just like, oh my gosh, you know, I have no idea what's going on. My tires were ripped off. At least I'd made it home. You know, there were other times where, you know, I left work to go to happy hour, and I took a wrong turn after happy hour and ended up in some city, I don't even know where it was, with my car in a ditch. And, you know, it still didn't occur to me that, you know, alcohol was my problem. I just had bad luck. And so even with the consequences that I was having, I just couldn't, you know, tie the two together, that alcohol was the problem. Shortly after the ditch accident, where I couldn't find my car and I was lucky to be alive, I started to think, you know, that maybe I should try to cut back. not, you know, not go out so much and, you know, just go home and where it was safe, and I wouldn't go out, and I tried that for a while, and that just wasn't much fun, and I thought, well, no, you know, and then I would try, you know, to go out just one night, and then it would just, the one night would lead, you know, I would come home 2 days, and, you know, my husband became less tolerant of that kind of behavior and those kinds of things, because he would just drink at home and he was fine, but I needed to go out, you know, that's where I wanted to go out and have fun, you know, I was the party girl out. Oh my gosh, raising hell. The more fun, the better. And at whoever's expense. And so finally, alcohol beat me into a state of reasonableness. You know, I had a moment of clarity. My husband was out of the country, and I was on a binge. And I'd been drinking for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 days, because at this point I had lost my job. I'd gotten fired because I had called my boss's wife and ripped her a new one on the phone, because that was a good idea. Why, I don't even know. I can't even remember, because I was a blackout drinker. I can't remember the circumstances around that, but I did it, and I lost my job, and I was devastated. And I knew I was in trouble, so now I was like, I was in trouble. My husband was out of the country. I'd been fired. I was on a binge, I was doing not good things, and it was just piling up on me. And so I ended up at the Florida Hospital Psychiatric, where they take you when the paramedics come, and you tell them that I'm fine, I just want to die. Click, click. Onto the gurney. Off I go. I'm like, oh, good Lord, what now? Now I'm Baker-acted. And I wasn't really sure what that meant, but I knew that I was in the emergency room, and they had given me some kind of charcoal because I had taken some pills, and it was not good. And so I was in there, and I didn't want to stay. So they told me I had to stay for 3 days or something like that, the Baker Act, I don't know what it is, 72 hours, okay, yeah, too long. And so I left the emergency room with the police guard, and managed to get out of the hospital and ran for my life, basically. And now I knew I was really in trouble. Now I got home and I called my sister, and she's like, "What are you doing there? You're supposed to be at the hospital." I'm like, "Well, I just left." She goes, "Oh my gosh, the police are looking for you." Oh my God. So now, you know, the fear is just, I'm full of it. I'm terrified. And I think at that point, you know, I kind of knew that I was probably done. Because I was just so tired of being sick and tired. I went home, and there was still alcohol in my house, and for some reason, I didn't want it. I think I was just too sick. I don't think I could have taken another drink. And I turned myself back in, you know, I called to make sure they weren't going to take me to jail first, and I've been to jail, you know, and I didn't want to go back to jail. That was very scary. And so I turned myself back in, and I was in the psychiatric ward over there for the 72 hours. And there was a counselor in there that told me that I had, you know, a couple of options, you know, and inpatient treatment, which I did not want to do. I didn't want someone to tell me when I could smoke and when I could go to the bathroom and things like that, you know, or I could go to AA, do 90 meetings in 90 days, which is what he suggested, or if I was lucky, he might see me back there. But, you know, most definitely if I didn't, you know, try one of these other things, that's where my path was leading. And I'd only been there once, so I don't know why he thought that, but that was his recommendation. And at this point, I was terrified and I was scared. So I heard somebody share the other day that they left the psychiatric ward, whatever, and came straight to Central, and that was pretty much what I did. They let me out. My husband brought me home, and I don't know how I found out about Central, but I came, and The very first person that I met here is here tonight. It was Marion, and she was in the coffee bar, and it was in the old house. And I just remember walking in and, you know, being, you know, terrified, ashamed, didn't know what I was going to do. You know, my world was, you know, over as I knew it. And I remember asking Marion, because the meeting guide was wrong, so there wasn't a meeting, and I had to wait to come back for a couple of hours, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it, you know. And I just asked Marion, I said, you know, what do I do if I want a drink? And she said, call me, and she gave me her phone number. Of course, I did not call. you know, but I didn't drink. I came to the meeting, and I sat in the back. I didn't tell anybody my name. I didn't want to be here. I couldn't believe that this was, you know, where I ended up, and that I didn't know what I was going to do. I was never going to have fun again. I was never going to celebrate a birthday again, or Christmas, and, you know, all the stuff that we think about when we're brand new that we're never going to get to do again with alcohol. And since it was my companion, I wasn't just sure how that was going to work. So I came to meetings. I came to meetings, you know, a couple of times a day because I had the time, because I did not have a job, and it, you know, it seemed to help. Every time I came, I felt a little bit better. You know, I felt a little more hope. And I came to the 6:30 a.m. meeting. That's a meeting that I consider that I got sober in, and I waited, you know, probably about 2 weeks before I asked somebody to be my sponsor, because I didn't think anybody wanted to help me. I was, you know, again, I was embarrassed and I was ashamed. And but it got to the point where I was more afraid that I was going to drink than I was to ask somebody to help me. So I asked a woman to be my sponsor and got started working the stuff of Alcoholics Anonymous. And So I'm sober for a little while, and I'm, you know, doing the best I can. You know, I don't do this thing perfect today. I'm sure I didn't do it perfect from the beginning. The one thing that I did do perfect, and the one thing that I do perfect every day, is that I know that I'm an alcoholic and that I cannot drink. And that if I drink, I'm going to die. So that's the only thing that the book says we have to do perfect, and that's the only thing that I've done perfect since I got sober. So, and I'm grateful for that, you know, that I don't have to be perfect in the program. It's progress, not perfection. So, you know, I'm kind of waxing and waning along and, you know, feeling okay. And I had been sober probably about, 4 months, and my mother died. And I thought, okay, well, this is a perfect opportunity to drink. This is a perfect excuse. You know, everybody would understand. You know, your mother died. That's what you do. You know, you drink because, and when the rest of my family had passed away, that's what we did. We got drunk. You know, and that was my solution. That was my comfort. That's what I knew. That's what I did. And but I can remember that, you know, in the back of my mind, I didn't really want to drink, you know, but the other part of your mind that says, oh, it's okay, you know. So I called my sponsor, and I talked to my sponsor from the whole way from my work, which is where I got the phone call, all the way to where my mom's house was. And by the time I got there, you know, I felt better. I felt, you know, as good as you can feel. We were there. My sister was there, who had gotten sober a short time after I did. And we were there, and we just kind of looked at each other and said, well, what are we going to do? And I said, well, we're going to go to a meeting. And it was a Thursday night, and we came to the 8 o'clock meeting, and we didn't drink just for the day. Mm. And it was a miracle, you know. And I can't say, because that is very hazy, that time period, you know, when you're newly sober and then with that kind of an event. I can't say where I was in the steps. But I know at that point, you know, that was, you know, a spiritual experience for me, that my mother had died and I did not drink. I did not pick up a drink. And right then and there, I knew that my sobriety was a gift, and it was grace. I didn't understand it, and I didn't need to understand it, but I knew that I was going to keep going. So I kept going, and I continued to work the steps, and and then I got pregnant. I like Oak Green. So a gift of sobriety, and so I continue to work the steps and get through that, and then, you know, then there was the miracle of a child is, you know, indescribable, and that comes with a lot of, anxiety and, unknowns and no mother to help you out. Like, what do I do? But, I had the women in the program, and I leaned on them. I got help from them. I did have my sister, and so that was another experience, that I was able to go through sober and continue to work the steps, because I had not finished my steps by then. All these things kept happening in my progress. But I just kept at it, and I didn't drink a day at a time. I got involved in service very, very early on. I think, probably like as soon as they can get you in, I started being part of the group conscience and being the secretary, taking the notes, and I've been doing that almost ever since. And that was a great experience, and, chairing the meetings. And once I finished the step, then, the great thing for me happened that I was able to sponsor another woman and really understand the program and understand the steps even more and get to see the light come on in somebody else's eyes and help them through the same things or similar things that I had been through. And, I think that when I got here, I didn't know that God was going to be the solution. I didn't want it to be the solution. I didn't really have a idea about God. I'd never been to church or any of that, but as I grew in the program and as I worked the steps, I realized that, God was the solution, and I was okay with that, and I rely on that heavily today. This is, I don't, that's why I'm like, I say 30, I'm like, oh my gosh. I think the thing for me for Alcoholics Anonymous is it has given me a way to live life that I didn't have before, because what I realized once I put the drink down and as I went through the steps is that, though I had a drinking problem, what I really have is a life problem. I have a living problem. I think that as it was revealed in my fourth step, I think that everybody has wronged me and that I have no part in anything and that I'm just this nice girl trying to help everybody out, and if these people would only act this way or this situation would only turn out this way, I'd be okay and I wouldn't have to drink so much. And an enlightening experience sitting down with a sponsor when you do your fourth step is for them to be able to tell you, yes, you're a sweet girl, but you are, you're selfish, you're self-centered, you're kind of trashy and kind of mean, you're a thief. And it's pretty eye-opening, and I'm just like, I didn't really know these things about myself. Maybe I did, and I just, shove them down with a little alcohol. And so it was enlightening, though very humbling, to learn these things about myself and then to find out that there wasn't really anything that I could do about it. That I was going to have God's help to do this. And so as I continue to, work the steps and try to apply them in my life, I know that I have gotten better in some things and not so much better in other things. I know that I don't get in as much trouble with myself as I used to. And if I get into trouble, I know how to get out of it a little quicker. I don't stay in it as long. I think the greatest gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is a way to be a good friend, a good mother, a better wife, and a good employee. Because what I also found out through my fourth and fifth step was that I wasn't any of those either. I was not a good wife, which I already knew that. And I was not a good, I was not a good sister. I was not a good employee, though I would tell you I was the best employee they ever had. And I was just, could not believe I had been fired. And that really, when I wrote down my resentments, that really, got me. But, because I was just devastated that they had fired me. And when I made my my list of people to make amends to, one of the first amends that I did was to that employer that had fired me, that, you know, I get catapulted me to, you know, sobriety, really, and his wife. And his wife was the office manager where I worked, and she was very mean. And she would race up and down the halls and tell us that the business was closing, you know, we didn't have enough money, and she was, oh, she was just so not a nice person. And I did not like her. I was scared of her. And so when I called to make an appointment with him to make the amends, you know, I requested that, you know, she would, you know, could I talk to her as well? And they set up the appointment, and then I drove out there. And I'm a dental assistant, so I work for a dentist. And so when I got there to make my very first amends, he was with a patient, and he was running like an hour and a half behind. And so I was just sitting and waiting, and I was downstairs smoking cigarettes and back upstairs, and I was like, how long is this going to take? And I was so afraid. I was more afraid to see her than I was to see him. Because I was, you know, he had always been a very nice guy, and I was pretty sure that, you know, he would understand what I had done and that, you know, he would be happy for me. I wasn't so sure about her. And so when he finally, you know, was done and I went, you know, in to meet with him, she was not there. She had left. She did not want to be there to see me. Which, you know, the book tells us that, you know, some people are not going to want to see you, and that's okay. So when I sat down to talk to him, to tell him about how I'd been a terrible employee and how I'd, you know, basically stolen his time, and he just kind of looked at me, you know, like he didn't understand, and he didn't think I, you know, had been all these terrible things. And as I tried to explain to him, you know, what I had done, he still seemed a little unsure of, you know, exactly what I had done. But he was very receptive. He was, you know, happy for me. He shared pictures of his grandchild. I shared pictures of my son. And it was a wonderful experience. And she was not there, which was a great relief. But I was ready, you know, to make my amends to her had she been there. When I left, it was the most freeing thing that, you know, I had done probably so far in sobriety. But I was still, you know, still this woman that I really needed to take care of, I felt like. So I mailed a letter and, you know, just told her that if she ever, you know, had the desire to meet with me, I would love to have a cup of coffee with her, and I haven't heard from her yet. She'll probably call tomorrow. Oh my heavens. But anyway, so, but, you know, but I stand ready, you know, if she so desires. And I had some other people that I tried to make amends to that, you know, didn't want to see me, and that was okay. If they ever decide that they want to see me, you know, I'm ready to make amends to them. My family, which I owed a lot of amends to, really are all gone. We're all gone by that time, except for my sister, who is here, and well, she's in North Carolina. And so I, you know, I wrote letters and I sent them off in balloons, and it was, you know, it was a very freeing experience as well, you know, just to get the stuff out on paper, kind of like the fourth step, you know, just to get it down, to write it, to send it, to know that, you know, to the best of my ability, I've tried to, you know, to right the wrongs. And today, probably, as far as amends go, you know, my living amends to my husband and just to society, I think, in general, is probably the biggest amends that, you know, that I have to make and that I try to make on a daily basis. I was recently out of town in an area that I lived in that I had really kind of forgotten about, that some things have cropped up, and I realized there were some people that that I had not remembered, you know, and my very first sponsor told me that, you know, I would remember things, you know, as I was ready, you know, as I was able to handle them. So I have some new things that have, you know, come up a bit, you know, that I need to write down, and I need to make amends to some people, and, you know, there were also some people on my list that, you know, that I was told it would just be better not to contact. And I followed the advice of, you know, of my sponsor. And, you know, some of those I was like, whew. But I'm ready. You know, if it happens and I need to do it, I'm ready. I wrote a lot of letters, and I'm not a good writer. I don't like to write things down. I don't want to feel the emotion. I don't want to be emotional. And I don't really want to ask for help still today. You know, I was in a women's meeting a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't want to go, and my sponsor wanted me to go. And I don't like women's meetings because we cry. And I got there, and I cried. And, oh, my gosh, you know. But it was interesting that when the woman who opened the meeting shared, and she was talking about how hard it was for her to ask for help, I was sitting in this room, and it was a round circle, kind of, and all the women are sitting there, and when she was talking about how hard it was to ask for help, everybody in the room was, you know, nodding their head, and, you know, so everybody could identify with this woman, and I'm thinking, why is it so hard for me to ask for help? You know, because I'm stubborn, and I'm prideful, and I don't want, you know, I don't want to feel weak, and, you know, or less than. I love, you know, my own worst critic, and I love to beat myself up, but, you know, that gets a little bit better all the time, and I have to go to more women's meetings. But I'll go, because, you know, I try to do what my sponsor says, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I'm a little more slowly on some things than others. You know, and then I think the greatest thing for me is probably, you know, step 10, where I know that when something's wrong with me, that, you know, the book tells me, you know, if I'm having a problem, that there's something wrong inside of me. And even though I may not like that, you know, that's really the truth. And that's probably why I don't like it the most, is because somebody's made me mad, or I'm in a situation where I feel like somebody's out to get me, because I think, you know, everybody at work is out to get me. And, you know, it's this disease of perception, you know. I think it's just, it's crazy. And that, you know, I cannot wait till the end of the day to do an inventory, you know, and figure out, you know, what went wrong, what was good, and what was bad. You know, usually right away, I take note of it. I doesn't mean I do something about it right away, but I know right away that something's wrong, and I've got to either talk to my sponsor about it, I need to call another alcoholic, and then I've got to go in, and I've got to say, I'm sorry. I'm wrong. Which is a very hard thing for me to do. I don't know why. You know, it is very interesting, though, sometimes, you know, to go into work when I've been in a situation with another female, typically, that, you know, that has upset me, or I think it's out to get me, and I have acted inappropriately. I have been rude. I've been, you know, silent scorn, and I'll show you. And to go in the next day and say, you know, I acted inappropriately, I was wrong, and I will do my best not to do it again. Now, I didn't say I would never do it again. I'll do my best, because I still have these defects of character that come flying out, and I have a short fuse sometimes, and I think, you know, depending on how spiritually fit I am, depends on what I can tolerate and, you know, how well I treat, you know, those around me. And I think the you know, seeking God first thing in the morning and asking for His help and asking Him to keep me sober is the best thing that I do during the day, and not take a drink. I know that I can't do it alone. I know I don't have to do it alone. And that was the other great news for me when I got here, is that I did not have to do it alone. It meant I had to ask for help, which I didn't want to do because I was just so terrified. You know, and if you're new, you know, we're all here to help you, and we all want to help you. And that's the greatest joy, you know, that we get, is to help another person. And, you know, when you're new, you don't think that. You just think, oh, I can just get out of here, get in and out, in and out, in and out. Nobody will know who I am, and it'll all be over soon type thing. And this just doesn't work that way. But, you know, I ask God to keep me sober every morning, you know, and I'm praying before, you know, I'm getting into my daily routine, you know, I'm praying with my son on the way to school. And I would say, well, you know, next to prayer again, you know, God, please keep me sober. And my son's like, what is that you're saying? And I said, what do you mean? He said, what's that extra thing that you're saying? And I said, well, it's just an extra prayer for mommy. Well, what is it? And I said, well, I'll tell you about it some other time. Okay. You know, so he doesn't, you know, he doesn't know that part of my life. And he sees my chips at home sometimes. And he's like, are these toys? Can I play with these? And I'm like, no, these are not toys. And, you know, I've got them all stacked up. I'm like, oh, don't mess with them. And he said, well, what are they, mommy? And I said, well, I'll explain that to you one day. And I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous because, unfortunately, or fortunately, you know, he'll probably need that white chair that's right there. And as I don't know, they say it's hereditary, and if it is, then he's got a double whammy. You know, and the last thing that I do, you know, at night before I go to bed is I get on my knees and I thank God for another day of sobriety. And for the grace to get through it without hurting somebody, you know, whether it be myself or somebody I'm working with or somebody at home, usually my husband. No, that's not really nice. Anyway. But, you know, and then you know, I don't like to say that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me my life back because I would not want that life back that I had for anything. It has given me a new life. You know, I've had things happen to me in sobriety, great and not so great, you know, exciting and not so exciting. And what I've been able to do, you know, just a day at a time, is know that a drink is not a solution, no matter what happened. When my mom died, when my dog died, when my brother-in-law died, you know, whatever happens, you know, I was told early on, you know, if your ass falls off, put it in a bag and take it to a meeting. And that's what I do, you know. I come to a meeting and I cry and I just say that, you know, I need help. And the other thing that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is probably a great thing for me, is that it's okay to not be okay. I don't have to be ha, 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 all the time because I'm not. But, you know, yeah, I'm not. And it's but it's okay, you know. And it's good to have a sponsor that knows me, that, you know, when I walk up and I'm all smiles, how you doing? I'm great. No, you're not. I'm like, okay. So, you know, I try to make a meeting every other day because, you know, through, you know, the gifts of sobriety, I do have a son, you know, and, you know, balancing work and, you know, other commitments that I have. I don't get to make a meeting every day, but, you know, I always try to be here every other day. You know, that's my goal. Because I know that picking up a drink for me is not an option because I know that I have another drink in me, but I don't know if I could get sober again. And that scares me in a healthy way. You know, I was, you know, blessed that, you know, I came in, I picked up one white chip, and I just, you know, a day at a time, have not had a drink in a very long time. And I've continued to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, help other women, come to meetings, do service work, and my life is good. You know, it's not perfect, but it's good. And I'm grateful to be sober and to be service of the group and to the women in my life that I've helped and that help me, you know, all the time. And I think that's it. Oh.